This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Botanic Garden, a stunning 52-acre garden in the heart of Brooklyn, featuring spectacular plant displays and inspiring public programs year-round. Learn more at bbg.org.
This week on Meetin' 3, we're examining the true cost of convenience when it comes to when, where, and how we eat.
Dark stores enable workers to eat without any kind of thought to how they're getting their food or how it might have come to be.
DoorDash, Uber, and Lyft in the past have pledged to spend $90 million to try to exempt themselves from the law.
I could be wrong, but I think there's going to be significant regulatory pushback on driverless trucks.
Tune in to Meetin' 3, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, and welcome to Why Food Podcast. This is a podcast about career changers, innovators, and entrepreneurs. I'm your co-host, Valerie Lomas, and my co-host, Ethan Frisch. He is somewhere between, I think, Spain and Turkey right now, sourcing spices for his company. If you want to follow his adventures along, you can follow him at Burlap and Barrel. I'm really excited today. We have a guest today that's going to talk to us all about spices and health, and that link. We have Kanchan Koya. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. So fun to be here.
Yeah. So, I mean, you have quite a fascinating background. You actually got a PhD from Harvard Medical School in molecular biology.
I did.
Okay. We have to talk about that because that's kind of like, I think that's like the pinnacle of education. So can you just maybe tell me about a little bit about your journey and how you ended up studying molecular biology at Harvard?
Yeah. So ever since I was 13 years old, growing up in India, I was just fascinated by DNA and molecules. Sounds ridiculous, but I just knew I was going to end up studying science, and I did. And I just kind of took one step in front of the next and ended up in the PhD program there and spent 6 years studying how our bodies repair damage to the DNA. So pretty wild stuff.
Okay, how do they?
that might not be an easy question, of, huh? Yes.
A six-year answer?
Exactly. Six-year answer, multiple ways. But I guess the realization was, yeah, our bodies are amazing things. We're equipped with all these different methodologies and molecular pathways to fix damage, which then when things get too kind of out of control or out of balance, we end up with disease. So that's what I studied.
Okay. So, I mean, so you got a PhD from Harvard, and now you run an entire platform called Spice Spice Baby. You create videos for Tasty. You run a podcast. How on earth did you end up going from, you know, having a doctorate degree to being in the world of food?
So I've always been obsessed with food, eating it, looking at it, seeking it out. So that was always kind of an undercurrent. And then actually during my PhD, my lab started to study turmeric, the spice, the golden spice that I grew up with in India and completely took for granted, even though my grandmother was convinced it cured every ailment. But my lab at Harvard started studying it, and it was kind of a crazy moment for me, having grown up in a culture where these ancient spices are just part of our everyday life. And we, like I said, kind of take them for granted. And then being at this world-renowned institution, and I was like, wait a second, all this like amazing ancient wisdom is really proving to be somewhat accurate by modern science. So I think for me, that was a planting of a seed moment where I really felt like, okay, maybe I'll sort of integrate all my interests, my expertise in science, and my love of food. And so fast forward 3 years later, when I became a mom and started feeding my son, who was 6 months old, spices in his baby food, and people started to give me some eyebrow raises, I realized there was an opportunity to educate folks about spices and to kind of combine all those things into one. And so that's how The platform was born. At the time, I didn't think it was a platform. I really thought it was just a hobby, but it kind of evolved from that into being really something that now I'm really excited to be a part of.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, let's rewind a little, right? So you're at Harvard Medical School, and the lab that you're in just happens to be studying about turmeric, the spice that you grew up eating in India that you said you kind of took for granted. How did you end up in this particular lab? And do you think that there was some, like, what was the connection? How did they just kind of end up studying this spice? Or were you kind of drawn to them because maybe they were drawn to that?
No, it really happened a few years into the lab. So I was interested in cancer and how our cells repair DNA and prevent cancer. So that was the starting point. And then somehow, as we were studying anti-cancer compounds, turmeric showed up because it actually does have some really potent anti-cancer properties from the compound curcumin, which is found in turmeric. So it really was like, I guess, synchronicity that it just, my lab was here studying turmeric, or haldi as we call it in India. And I was like, wow.
So, I mean, turmeric, it's really like fashionable right now.
So fashionable. A little too fashionable.
It's having a moment. Like,
yeah.
You see it everywhere, from like golden lattes to like turmeric ice cream. Like, are we getting the benefits when we have it? And like how can we, I guess, get the benefits from that spice? Or, you know, is the fashionable moment, do you think that's like a good thing for the spice? Or
overall, yes, I think it's a really good thing for the spice. I do think turmeric and a host of other spices have amazing health benefits that are now being recognized and celebrated at all these trendy cafes. It's a great question about turmeric and the health benefits and whether we're getting those health benefits when we have those lattes. So a couple of things to keep in mind. And again, just going back to ancient wisdom, you know, my grandmother would concoct a turmeric latte. She didn't call it that.
What did she call it?
We called it haldi doodh in India, which means literally turmeric milk. And honestly, ask any Indian kid, it was the most disgusting thing because it was overloaded with turmeric. And, you know, you're 10 years old and you're like, I don't want to drink this thing. So, but you had to, because it was supposed to be this panacea cure all. And if you had a cold or cough, like, it was coming out of the kitchen, whether you liked it or not. So yeah, no, I think, you know, the fact that, so let's just step back. So for turmeric and curcumin in particular, which is one of the bioactive compounds in turmeric, there are many others, but curcumin happens to be the most well-studied. For curcumin to be absorbed in the body is not actually so trivial. So it's very rapidly cleared by the liver. And for you to have the benefits and really absorb it into your bloodstream, you need to do a few things. One is you need to combine it with black pepper, which can really help, which is why a thoughtfully designed latte would probably have a little sprinkling of black pepper. You don't need a lot, so it doesn't have to be like a weird pepper latte. It could literally be just a sprinkling, but there's a compound in pepper called piperine, which helps curcumin get absorbed in the body. So that's one cool kind of hack. And then the second thing is you really ideally want to warm the spice in some sort of a fat source. So a lot of ancient cultures that use turmeric will often let it bloom in kind of oil or ghee. And that's obviously like a really pretty step when you're cooking, but it also may have a rationale when it comes to the health benefits, because it seems like curcumin is activated by heat and fat and also made more bioavailable that way.
Okay, I hope everyone caught that, because that is definitely something I'm going to keep in my back pocket, like heat up turmeric and fat and then add a little bit of black pepper to activate it to get those health properties. Okay, so let's also just maybe move forward a little bit, right? So you had a baby, okay? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, were you working in your industry that you were educated in at that time? And did you kind of maybe take that break and you had this aha moment?
Yeah, I was working in biotech. So I was very much on the traditional path. I finished the PhD. I started a biotech company. So I think the entrepreneurial streak was always alive and well in me. I like taking risks. I like building things from nothing. I like jumping and having no idea what I'm doing and figuring it out. That definitely is a trend now that I look back. I also get bored really easily by sort of very protocol-driven jobs. So I like to be wearing multiple hats at once. So I think all of that was at play somehow. But Yeah, I was in biotech, and then my husband was asked to move to Hong Kong for a job opportunity, and we were like, yeah, let's go. So we went with my six-month-old son, and I guess that was like a combination of things that made me pause from biotech. I thought I was going to take some time just to be a mom for a little while, explore Asia, and that's really when Spice Spice Baby happened, or the idea for it happened.
Okay, so that's pretty cool, right? So you had this moment where you're living in a new city, you're in Asia, so you've got access to probably a completely different like palette of spices available to you. And you have this moment where you start this platform as a hobby, as something to do, right? At what point do you realize that maybe this was more than a hobby? And at what point did you realize that you weren't going to go back to biotech?
Yeah, great question. I think it was a bit of like a gradual realization. But 3 years into blogging for Spice Spice Baby, I had to ask myself, okay, this has been a passion project, but now what? You know, my son was older, he was a toddler. I was itching to kind of have a challenge again. I loved blogging. I loved recipe creation. I really enjoyed the food photography aspect. So all these things that came with constructing Spice Spice Baby, the blog and the platform, I loved. And so I basically said to myself, I love all these things. They combine all my interests and my expertise in some way. Why don't I just do this? Like, why not move this to kind of a business or like entrepreneurial venture category? And so I think for me, the big switch came when I decided to do my cookbook. So once I decided, okay, I'm going to create a product and I'm going to crowdfund it and I'm going to create this cookbook and the spice resource, it was now a business because I was selling a product. And I think that was the big kind of switching moment.
Yeah, I love what you're saying about that, this idea of actually selling a product. Because as a blogger, right, like sometimes, you know, I have to ask myself and other bloggers or people who are creating content for social media, like, okay, so what are we creating here? Are we creating something that we can sell? Are we like literally just creating content and like putting ideas out there, or is there a tangible product? So I love that you had that entrepreneurial sense to understand like, okay, I'm creating like a physical product that people can purchase. Was it directly from you and your
Yeah, so site? Initially it was directly through the site and then it went on Amazon, mm-hmm. but eventually, yeah, in the beginning it was through the blog.
Right, and you crowdfunded it, which is incredible. Can you maybe just speak a little bit about that? Because I know there are a lot of people out there that have ideas, whether it's, you know, self-publishing a cookbook or something else, and, you know, a success story with crowdfunding, I think we would like to hear.
Yeah, you know, I love that you brought that up about how bloggers sometimes, you know, don't think about monetization of content. And then, honestly, I'll be really honest. For me, making money through my content was always a little bit of a weird thing. Like, I was like, oh, but, you know, I'm a creator. I should create for free.
Right.
The point is, lots of people that I really respect always give the same advice that if you don't charge for something eventually, you literally can't just stick around forever. So if you want to share your passion and your mission with the world and help make the world a better place through whatever you're doing, eventually you're going to have to sustain that with the capital of the world, which is cash.
Yes, so, it is.
So better get creative and integrate that into your creator model, right?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I love that you said that because I have struggled with that also. It's like, do you put ads up on your site, or do you accept sponsored content?
Right.
And that sort of thing. But like you said, it just gets to a point where it's not sustainable. And even if it is your passion, if you're not being compensated for it, you're going to burn out. So
yeah. And I'll say one more thing, which is I think people value content that they pay for more than free content as well. So
that is a really great point.
So as a creator, don't feel like you're being shady. I mean, you're creating something of value.
Right.
There's value, and the currency by which we determine value in the world is cash, you know? So let
you're
the value
right.
shine through. Yes. This was a process for me. So it's easy for me to sit here and be like, oh yeah, you know, charge and don't feel bad about it. Like
right.
it was a process for me.
Right. No, and I love that you said that, you know, you were blogging for 3 years and then you know, you asked yourself like, so what next? Because I think that a lot of us people who have blogged or or are living in this world of content creation, you do get to that point where it's like, yeah, this started as a hobby and it was an outlet and it was fun and I had free time. But, you know, like you said, the currency of the world, you know,
right,
is money. So yeah, let's talk about money.
Yeah. So crowdfunding. So, you know, back then, I have to say I was a little bit old fashioned. So in my head, I thought, I'm going to do a product, so it has to be a tangible product. And a cookbook just seemed very logical because I was creating recipes. And I also went out looking for a book that would teach me about spices and their health benefits and show me how to use them in the kitchen. And I couldn't find a book like that. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to write a book that I felt like was missing from the space.
Very, very smart idea. Like, you see a hole, so you realize you're the best person to fill it, right?
Right. And I also felt a bit like an imposter, not going to lie. Like, wait, like, you know, I just been doing this for 3 years. People have been studying spices for decades. Like, what makes me qualified? I had all of those limited beliefs.
Right.
Believe me.
Even with your PhD and your background growing up in India, land of turmeric, and
yes,
the wisdom of the elders that you continue to speak of, that I don't have that wisdom in the back of my mind. But yeah.
I still had the things holding me back, the inner very loud critic that was like, who are you that you're going to write this book? And then also I felt like an imposter on the food side because I was a self-taught food lover / home cook. I wasn't professionally trained. I'd never worked in a professional kitchen. So I'm like, wait, I'm going to write a cookbook? Like, so anyway, I overcame all that inner dialogue. I just did it anyway. Crowdfunding happened, honestly, because I was having coffee with a friend in Hong Kong who happens to be a marketing person. And she said, you have a following on the blog. It's like, seems to be very engaged and very dedicated. And frankly, you don't need to have that many backers to successfully crowdfund a cookbook. Do the math. If everybody, you know, contributes $20 to $40, like once I did the math, I realized I really just needed 500 people to back the book. And I had about, you know, 1,000 subscribers. So I was like, well, maybe 1 in 2 will back the book and then maybe the family will be a little extra generous
or
my friends or whatever. So once I got over that mental hurdle that crowdfunding meant millions of people had to back my project, it felt very doable. And I was also given the advice by the same dear friend that crowdfunding is almost like a marketing exercise. So by putting out the campaign, you're already drawing attention to the fact that it exists. You're letting people know the product exists. They're pre-ordering the product and helping you get it out into the world. It's a total win-win. So I was like, you know what? Fine, I'm going to do it.
I love that. I love what you said about doing the math, right? Because, you know, I think I probably thought, currently at least, think how you were thinking, like, how on earth does, you know, a normal, typical person with, you know, a healthy but, you know,
right,
not massive following, how on earth does a regular person crowdfund something?
Right.
But like you said, if you do the math and you figure out what your budget is, it does sound doable. And you did it.
I did it. We outraised our goal. So we raised 32 plus thousand, which helped me photograph, print, design, blah, 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 everything that needed to be done for the book. And I also wanted it to look not like a self-published book. I wanted it to look like any other really nice cookbook. So people would be proud to own it, put it on their coffee table. And it really did turn out that way. So I'm so grateful it worked out. It was a mad hustle.
Right.
It happened.
How many people donated to the campaign?
So it was about, I think it was just under 500. So my math was right. Yeah.
That's incredible. Like, I don't know. I'm actually writing a cookbook right now.
Oh.
So I'm just sitting here like thinking, and I love that you had like almost 500 people who were literally invested in your project. So they were almost like little ambassadors once it came out because they had, like you said, they had put their value in it, like actual money.
Yes, it was converting a fan into a paying customer, and that's not always easy. But I was really authentic in my story around why I was doing the book and how I needed their help. And I wasn't going to a publisher and I wanted creative autonomy. I didn't even go to publishers. I didn't even try the conventional route. I just decided I'm going for it. You know, I wanted to get this out quickly. And I think crowdfunding allowed me to do that. I didn't have to wait. Lots of advantages. But like I said, a crazy hustle.
Yeah. So what was the timeline with you once you like closed the campaign and then were able to get the book out?
So the crowdfunding actually helped me get the book out on time. It was a couple months delayed, which I felt really bad about, but apparently that is no big deal.
It isn't.
So I was like, okay, kind of came out in January, was going to come out in like October, November. So yeah, I feel like once I promised my backers they were going to have the book by the end of the year, I was like, I better get this book out, you know?
I love that, the accountability factor totally, as well.
Totally.
Oh, that's such an awesome story. So how have things changed with your blog and your whole platform since putting the book out, or have they?
Absolutely. Another big reason to do the book, which I guess I wasn't thinking about so strategically, but now that I look back, is it just builds tremendous credibility and brand recognition. So now I'm a legitimate player in the kind of spices food scene because I have a product. It could have been a digital product, and this is something I'm exploring now. But back then in my head, I was like, it has to be a real tangible product. And, you know, right. We can talk about that maybe, but it's nice to have something people can hold, feel, touch, use daily in their kitchen. So I'm glad I went the physical product route, at least for my first product. But yeah, I think it's just legitimize the brand. People know about it. They take me seriously as an entrepreneur because I actually put a product out there. I take myself seriously as an entrepreneur because I put a product out there. So lots of kind of psychological benefits, if you will. And then right. Of course, because I self-published, you know, the margins and the return on your investment are in your favor. It's time consuming and requires a lot of effort and strategic thinking to get a self-published book successfully out into the world. But if you can, you're rewarded in terms of the margins because you're literally the only person.
Right. Well, I love what you said about kind of overcoming the mental hurdles, right? Dealing with like feeling like an imposter. And you said you just did it, right?
Yeah.
I think that's just like such valuable advice. Like instead of, you know, spending energy necessarily thinking about why you're not qualified to do something, just go ahead and do it. And then once you finished, it's like you have this amazing thing to be proud of. So yeah. That's awesome. That's a really inspiring story. So congratulations. And
thank you
for sharing that. But let's maybe talk a little bit about recipes, right? Yeah. So you wrote a cookbook, so it's full of recipes.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing you never studied recipe writing in school.
I did not.
So how did you come to be a recipe writer, tester, and a confident one at that? Was that through the years of blogging, or do you have like any family background with, you know, just recipes being handed down? Or
so definitely the blogging helped at least give me a basic structure. Like this is what a recipe should look like. These are the things to pay attention to. But really what helped the recipes in the cookbook read and translate really well, I think, is the editor. Mm-hmm. So I found a dear friend who happens to be just really amazing at recipe writing and editing cookbooks. And she was just so instrumental and very critical in a good way. And she was like, I don't understand this. Like, you know, really put a lot of time and effort into little details that ended up resulting in, I think, a very clearly written book. So yes, find an amazing editor.
I love that advice. Know where you have weaknesses and make sure that you are using your network and your resources to fill them. So let's maybe talk a little bit more about Spice Baby, your blog and main platform. So if someone were to go on there, like what can they find and what should they be looking for?
Yeah, so Spice Baby is really about demystifying spices for a global audience. Many people find spices intimidating, a little bit too exotic or esoteric, pull them out once in a blue moon for that one curry recipe. And my mission is to just make them daily stars in your kitchen because they're so incredible. They're so versatile. They're so wonderful. They have these amazing health benefits. They liven up food. If Ethan was here, he would definitely corroborate.
I know. Ethan is our resident spice master, obviously.
I know. And I'm obsessed with burlap and barrel spices, just saying. But yeah, I was like, you know, all these amazing, vibrant gifts from nature should not be sitting in the back of your cabinet for a once a year usage. So Spice Baby will inspire you to bring out your spices. I talk about how to care for them, when to throw them out, how to really get the most out of them in terms of storage, buying whole spices and grinding them. And then I dive into about 15 spices in my book and on my platform and my blog, where I really educate the reader about the health benefits of these spices as evidenced by modern medicine and modern science. And I kind of, there's a lot of research out there, so I try to break it down and really say, like, here we can really say this has a benefit. Here we are not so sure. So I really try to be very honest about what the science says. And then I'm like, you know, here's how you cook with it daily. So not everything's a curry recipe. Sometimes it's a frittata. Sometimes it's oatmeal. Things that we enjoy every day as global citizens. Really incorporating spices into your everyday. That is what the inspiration hopefully will be for you.
I love that. Okay, so we are actually going to take a quick break and we will be back and we're going to talk more about spices.
This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Botanic Garden, a stunning 52-acre garden in the heart of Brooklyn, featuring spectacular plant displays and inspiring public programs year-round. Harvest Homecoming, an old-school fall foliage festival, comes to Brooklyn Botanic Garden on Sunday, October 20th. Celebrate cider season with New York cider houses and kombucha makers, bringing hard and soft ciders and fermented drinks to try or buy. A pop-up farmers market will feature heritage apples from local orchards. Groove to the sounds of fresh Americana music and world beats throughout the day. Bring your friends and family and make a day of it with hay rides, lawn games, a children's Halloween costume parade, and more, all in the heart of Brooklyn. Learn more about Brooklyn Botanic Garden at bbg.org.
Hi, so we are back. I am speaking with Conchon Coya about everything related to spices and health. So let's just talk a little bit about spices and kids, right? So you said you were, you know, when you started your platform, you were feeding your infant spices and people were kind of raising their eyebrows at you. So can kids have spices?
Absolutely. In many parts of the world, they do. No eyebrow raises required. that was really the inspiration for me to start Spice Spice Baby in the beginning. Now, of course, it's about general education of spices for the whole family, all ages. But yes, kids can absolutely have spices. And I really believe that if we spice up their food, they will have more adventurous palates, potentially get more health benefits out of their food, and just have more of a love for vibrant food.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think that idea is finally getting out now because I went to the Specialty Food Association show earlier this year, and there were actually like packaged baby foods that were featuring spices. And I don't think I'd seen that before.
Yeah, it's definitely changing, I think, in a good way. My almost 3-year-old will only eat baked sweet potato fries with sumac. She will literally not eat them plain. So I think it's what we expose them to and how we train their palate. And I just really like to encourage parents to start young.
I love that. So it has great health benefits, but also will just awaken, you know, the next generation to this wonderful like palette of flavors that are out there.
Totally.
Yeah. So let's talk about something else that you do that I think is pretty cool. You actually make videos for Tasty through BuzzFeed.
Yeah. So over a year ago, I got an email. I had been on Instagram. I was pretty active. I had a few thousand followers. I had come out with the book. I was like, okay, this platform is like my business now. And, you know, I'm going to create content, maybe another product. And I get an email from BuzzFeed. I literally think it's spam because I'm like, what? And from a casting scout that said, we found you somehow and we would like to audition you to be part of BuzzFeed Tasty's Creators Program, which is a new talent initiative where they're bringing in external talent, chefs, content creators, whatever. So I was like, wow, this, you know. So anyway, I did it. I auditioned and I got the placement on the talent bench. So I am now one of BuzzFeed's external talent / creators. And it's been so fun and frankly game-changing for my business. BuzzFeed's audience is insanely huge. Tasty is the largest food network online, period. So a big part of the partnership has been them bringing a new audience to me and my content. So my growth on social, I fully attribute to them. Yeah, it's just been a really rewarding partnership on both sides. And I mean, their video team is just amazing. I walk in, I make my recipe, they make the video. It's a win-win. Yeah, it's been really fun.
That's awesome. So where can we find those videos?
So just everywhere where you can see Tasty videos, which would be their Facebook page, which I think now has almost 100 million followers, YouTube, Instagram. Yeah, just Google Tasty Kanchan Koya. You should find some stuff.
Awesome. And let's also just talk a little bit about your podcast.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about your podcast.
Well, who doesn't have a podcast these days, right? So basically what happened is I was creating content for Spice Spice Baby, which was mostly for mothers and dads sometimes, but really mostly mothers, educating them about how to feed their kids healthy spiced food. And in the process, I realized that most mothers were struggling with their own health and well-being. They were spread too thin. They were prioritizing everyone else in the family. And I really believe from my own experience as a mom that if moms feel good, excuse me, everybody wins. And so that just led to me wanting to create something for mothers specifically, still under this umbrella of health and wellness, but really sharing science-backed tips, lifestyle changes, and methodologies so mothers can feel their best. Mm-hmm. It's a tall order, I know. But Mom Light, the podcast, was born out of that kind of mission. It's been out for a few months now. It's been one of the coolest things I've done. You're a host. You know how it is. It's like so enriching every time you have one of these conversations. So yeah, the podcast is out. And then there's a platform, again, which is about just sharing tips with moms. I have a digital health coaching program now called the Mom Light Bootcamp, which takes moms through 8 weeks of a health transformation all online. So yeah, it's been a really fun kind of extension of my interest in health and wellness beyond just what's on your plate.
Right. I love that. So you're kind of getting like outside of food and into lifestyle also.
Yes.
That's really cool. So I guess let's just kind of end. Ethan and I, we typically do this like rapid fire.
I knew it.
Round of questions.
Okay.
But I guess it'll just be me since I'm alone today.
Okay.
All right. I know we've talked a lot about spices, but what's your favorite vegetable?
Ooh, sunchokes.
Oh, I had those for the first time a few weeks ago. Why are they your favorite? I have some thoughts about them.
I know you might. I feel like I can guess what the thoughts might be. So yeah, Jerusalem artichoke sunchoke, I think highly underappreciated. One of the most powerful prebiotic foods. Sorry, the scientist in me cannot resist. But the fiber in sunchokes really feeds the good bacteria in your gut. So if people want to add more beneficial fiber that's going to give them a healthier microbiome, really you want to start with sunchokes. They can be a little like flatulence producing for some people. And that's just because you're training the bugs, you know, But I just love them. They're like sweet and savory and earthy. And I usually roast them in the oven with a little turmeric and oil and salt and cayenne pepper. So good.
That sounds so good. I roasted them when I made them a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
So let's say aside from spices that we've already mentioned, what's your favorite health boosting spice and why? So you can't say turmeric or sumac or black pepper.
Or cayenne, which I just said. I am going to say cinnamon. And it's that season, you know, starting to see like whatever, the holidays. Yeah, so cinnamon, I think, is another very well-studied spice. And I really like to draw the distinction between regular cinnamon, which is called cassia cinnamon, and true cinnamon, which I know Burlap and Barrel has. They call it cinnamon verum. It's also called Ceylon cinnamon because it originally comes from the island country of Sri Lanka. And the distinction is important because true cinnamon has very low, if any, levels of a compound called coumarin, which is a liver toxin at high enough doses. So if you're somebody who's like just going to town on the cinnamon every day, which I think you should because it really has some amazing health benefits, you want to really seek out the true cinnamon or the Ceylon cinnamon so that you're not giving yourself like a liver toxicity issue in the process. But I would say true cinnamon would be the one because it's amazing for blood sugar control, powerful anti-inflammatory, and may even just boost your mood even by just smelling it.
Okay, what was the non-true cinnamon called?
So it's just, if you don't see, right, I know, non-true cinnamon. If you see a bottle that says cinnamon, you can assume it's the generic kind of cassia cinnamon variety.
Got it.
Yeah, nothing wrong with it. And it's a stronger, bolder flavor. So it's good in some meat dishes and curries. But if you're using cinnamon regularly, I would definitely
find
use
the good
true.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, so what are some of, like, if you're someone who maybe live somewhere not in New York City, where can you find good spices? Where should we be buying our spices? Because now I'm a little skeptical of, like, grocery store cinnamon.
Yeah. I mean, Ethan's not here and I don't work for Burlap and Barrel, but I love Burlap and Barrel. I buy, you know, they ship nationwide. Yeah, I've just really, really loved their spices. Single origin, super high quality. I also love a couple other spice brands which are growing their inventory. One of them is Diaspora Co. She may have actually been on the show before. Sana is the founder. They make an amazing turmeric and cardamom. But I think there's a movement now towards more single origin, thoughtfully sourced spices, which I think is amazing.
Right. So I guess just like as consumers and as people who are trying to, as you said, you know, make spices daily stars in our everyday cooking, we should just be a little bit more intentional when we buy spices and maybe find those high quality ingredients, even if that means, you know, purchasing online.
Yeah.
It's worth it.
Absolutely. And a little goes a long way with spice. So even if you feel like the jar is expensive, it's going to last you a while, especially if you store it well, away from heat and light, that sort of thing. So, you know, worth the investment for sure.
Got it. All right. And what is your favorite spicy kid food?
Ooh, kid. I thought you were going to say spicy food and then I knew what I was going to say. But then you threw in the kid. I would probably say tandoori chicken. The Indian classic, you know, you can make it mild. So like a mild tandoori chicken for my kids. But I would add more chili pepper to mine.
What goes in tandoori chicken?
Oh my gosh, it's this blend of amazing spices, fenugreek, pepper, cayenne, cumin, coriander. I mean, a long list of spices. It's a tandoori masala blend. You can buy it, you can make it, and then usually the chicken is marinated with yogurt, ginger, garlic, the spice blend, a little lemon juice, extra chili powder if you're me.
And oh, wow. Then, yeah. And now I'm hungry.
Me too.
Okay. And for the last question, what is your favorite kitchen utensil?
Ooh, okay. So I would have to say it's this Indian thing. Maybe the Indian listeners will know. It's a wooden, it's called a mandira. And it's basically something that allows you to get into a soup and like go back and forth like this and pulverize it. But we're just going to call it a pulverizer, but it's wooden. And so say you have a thick stew and you want to liquefy it a little bit without making it like a soup. That's the thing. I need to find the English term for it.
Wait, what's it called again in Indian?
It's called a mandira.
Okay.
Never going to find it here. My mom just sent me one from India.
Oh, nice. Okay. So thank you so much for being a guest and giving us all a little more insight into the world of spices and health. So can you please let our listeners know where they can find you on social, your website, all of that?
Thank you for having me. It's been so fun. You can find me on Instagram where I'm super duper active and I'm Chief Spice Mama. That's C-H-I-E-F Spice Mama on Instagram. And then spicebaby.com is where you'll find the recipes, links to the cookbook. And then momlight.com is where you'll find everything about lifestyle for mommy health and wellness.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And you can find our podcast on social at Why Food Podcast. You can also email us. And I am Valerie. And you can find me on Instagram at Foodie in New York. And Ethan, again, is Burlap and Barrel. Thank you so much, everyone. See you next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.